Let's start what we have come into the room to do. Right on. Here goes. One, two, three.
Hello, Ann Arbor. Hello, world. This is WCBN FM Ann Arbor. It's hot in here. Your show on environmental news, views, and grooves. I'm your host, Pearl Zeng. Today, we're having a show on GIS, the wide-use technology that has been applied into numerous fields, including utilities, natural resources, transportation, navigation, like our Google Maps. And today, the focus of our show is, of course, on GIS application in the environmental field. And actually, my co-host Sam Monar is also very skillful in GIS. Right, Sam?
Well, I would say that I'm more of just a dabbler compared to our guests that we have in the studio today. We have David Betcher.
Hello.
And Mark Yoders.
Hello.
Welcome, guys. So today we're going to do a show on geographic information systems, and we'll do a little airing of the grievances around why we hate Esri. And but before we do that, this week is Michigan Mammal Week, so everyone is going to tell our audience what your favorite Michigan mammal is. Mine is the mink, because it can hunt animals much bigger than itself.
I'd have to say my favorite one is the spider monkey, because I mean, there's nothing cooler than being able to use your tail as another arm.
David?
Well, this past winter I was up in Traverse City, and I had the chance to see what I think was a bobcat very briefly, and that was pretty cool. So I would say that was my favorite.
Mine is super common. Squirrels.
Who doesn't love a squirrel? All right, so we're going to go into music, and then we'll come back with our guests. The first song is called In Every Direction by Junip.
Direction.
back, WCBN-FM Ann Arbor. It's our show on GIS. I really want to say that I'm in the room with three really, really great GIS professionals, so I'm going to ask questions for our general audience. And also, for you who are listening live to the show, if you have questions or comments, you can call in at 734-763-3500. And just like the song just played, some of the newer technologies are allowing our guests to measure in every direction. So why don't we start by them introducing themselves? David, do you want to start?
Sure. My name is David Betcher. I've been up in Ann Arbor for about a year, working with the Great Lakes Commission. Mostly my projects are focused on invasive species, especially sea lamprey control and oil spill contingency planning is another main area that I'm focused in. Yeah.
David also ate some cow liver recently.
I did, and heart.
And it was delicious.
How about you, Mark?
Hi, yes, I'm Mark Yoders. I am an analyst with Quantum Spatial, which is a larger national-level GIS and remote sensing company, and they have a branch office here in Ann Arbor. A lot of the work that I do focuses around environmental planning and also assessments, and I'll get a little bit more into that later.
Okay, so before we really get started, so can any one of you introduce more about GIS, like what it is and what is it used for?
Oh, I think one of the things that makes GIS such a powerful tool is that it gives us new eyes on things that have been studied in other ways. So rather than having a table of information or just a written document explaining a certain situation, now we can visually see things in an accurate way that really opens up new doors for understanding.
Yeah, and just to back up a little bit for those that aren't sure what GIS actually stands for, it's Geographic Information Systems, and it's usually coupled with another acronym, RS, called Remote Sensing. And remote sensing, in essence, is just taking pictures. If you point them toward the Earth, or you can point them to the sky and out into space. So GIS, particularly, it actually opens up quite a few different applications because now we are allowed to look and explore the relationships between a particular location and information at that location. And the other nice thing about GIS is that it allows you to stack these layers on top of each other and do additional calculations, assessments, and modeling off of that.
So talking about stacking layers, Sam, I know that this year you have been working on a GIS project for Detroit, right?
And yeah, so I worked on a project that stacked 9 or 10 different data sets on top of each other to create an index of how vulnerable different areas of Detroit are to climate change. And so, yeah, we used some satellite imagery from remote sensing and some big census data and some market data, and it pops out a nice little map for you. And, you know, a lot of maps are useful for learning about the Earth and climate change and the environment. And some maps are useful for when you're just on a summer road trip, which brings us to our next song by Willie Nelson, On the Road Again, which is a song that my dad used to scream at the top of his lungs when I would drive with him. And now I do the same thing. So let's listen to it. Willie Nelson, On the Road Again.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again. Life I love is making music with my friends, and I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Going places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again. Like a band of gypsies, we go down the highway. love is making music with my friends. And I can't wait to get on the road again.
Welcome back to WCBN FM Ann Arbor, the extreme left of your dial, and Ann Arbor Art Fair's unofficial radio show. It's hot in here, your environmental news and grooves. Right before we went to that great song by Willie Nelson, Mark was talking about his work at Quantum Spatial and what remote sensing is, and the idea of looking at things from space to figure out what's going on the ground is pretty amazing. So, Mark, what are some of your favorite things to look at from these satellite images to look at from the vantage point of space?
Well, you know, there's quite a few different things, but I have to say probably trees and forests, as my background is in forestry primarily. And then I kind of added on seeing where environmental GIS was going. I decided to kind of add on GIS and remote sensing to the master's degree. So for me, a lot of the work that I can do in forestry is relying on some new technologies and newer technologies, I should say, and LIDAR being probably one of the hottest topics that are out there right now. LIDAR is light detection and ranging, and in essence, it's an active sensor that is shot out of a plane or a satellite or a helicopter. And what it does is it literally times the wave as it's coming out of the sensor and when it hits the ground and bounces back. And knowing the time that it takes for something to bounce back, we can estimate, or actually calculate, not even estimate, the height of objects.
And so what does that do for you when you're able to measure the height of a forest?
Well, it's actually opening up some applications that were traditionally more difficult to assess, and it actually makes some of the work easier. And what kind of work that we end up doing is when we're able to map trees and know their height and their diameters, then from there, there's a lot of, they call them allometric equations, that you can start to make characteristics based off of these diameter and these height measurements. So using those, we're able to then start mapping out forests, and we can calculate everything from the amount of CO2 being sequestered. We can estimate, more accurately, the amount of CO2 being sequestered or released from certain forests. And we can also do other applications with utilities. And utilities obviously have some problematic trees that could come down on the lines. So in order to help keep the electricity on and running, we actually end up using LIDAR frequently to, in some parts of the country, frequently to measure trees and their potential to actually fall into right-of-ways.
So is there a specific project you can share?
Sure. One project that we're working on right now is with a utility company in the western half of the United States. And what we're doing is we're taking this LIDAR and we're classifying the trees. And by classifying the trees, then we're able to, classifying the trees in height, we're able to then estimate using some other types of layers, such as hyperspectral imagery, which is, in essence, a variety of different wavelengths.
In terms of the wavelengths that you use, what type of bands do you generally focus on in terms?
Well, for actually species identification modeling, a lot of those bands, it's dependent upon the individual species. But in general, one other wavelength that we tend to use a lot of in forestry and environmental is the infrared band. The infrared band of imagery actually is a relatively good indicator of overall health and photosynthesis in a plant. So typically when you're looking at the infrared band, you're able to see the darker areas and the more intense or lighter areas, and using those kind of wavelengths can actually help you decide whether or not a tree might be declining or diseased or dead entirely. So Using those types of bands in combination, the LIDAR, the infrared, the hyperspectral imagery, we've been able to create a process that helps manage these power lines and look for potential areas of outages, or in this case, out west, potential spots for fire flare-ups.
So, Mark, so when you're identifying different tree species or the heights of trees, what you mean when you're saying you're looking at infrared or you're looking at a hyperspectral area of the spectrum, what you're really saying is that you're just looking at the light that's coming off these objects to understand them. Is that right?
Exactly, except for the case of the LIDAR, which we had just spoke about a little bit, being an active sensor. Mm-hmm. A lot of the sensors, the infrared, the multispectral, are passive sensors, and they're actually looking for the light reflected off of whatever the surface it may be hitting. Yes.
I'm curious about what are the pictures look like, and how are they taking the pictures, and what do you see on your screen, and how do you turn into some imageries that people can understand? Like, what's the process like?
Well, typically, like we had mentioned with the remote sensing, once you are able to acquire and calibrate the imagery, and the reason why we need to calibrate could be for a variety of reasons, some of which being that depending on how high the sensor is from the ground, you get actually some hazing and some cloudiness on the imagery for it having to pass through the atmosphere. So after the calibration stage, and you're able to, in essence, clean up the imagery. From there, there's a variety of tools, including ArcGIS, IRIDAS Imagine, MicroStation, Global Mapper, and a variety of other tools that will let you begin to either segment or classify the imagery. And by segmentation, it's a routine where it essentially looks for distances around a certain area, and it draws a line around it, and that's again based on intensity or LIDAR returns or other types of returns. And then another typical way is for raster imagery, and raster is your classic take a picture with your phone, and each little pixel has a value attached to it. And when you are able to know what that value is, then you can start to clump like values together. And then through iteration after iteration, you can actually start to build out some information based solely off the imagery itself.
In terms of the forestry applications and things like that, who are some of the end users of your products that you're creating?
Well, actually, it's quite varied. There are everything from municipal level contracts to state and federal level, and then even the private sector, like we were mentioning, utilities and some other large landowners even, or they call them timber investment management organizations. They're interested in using this as well to help map the growth and cutting cycles and replanting cycles for their forest holdings.
Sure.
Wow, so you can really see how the eagle eye view is so important to a lot of companies and governments and NGOs. And being able to fly like an eagle can be really valuable. And that brings us to our next terrible pun, which is Fly Like an Eagle by the Steve Miller Band.
Living in the street. Oh, there's a saloon. keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into the future.
Welcome back, WCBN FM Ann Arbor. It's hot in here. We were just talking about some projects that Mark works on related to using the technology of LiDAR. So what are some other GIS technologies or remote sensing technologies out there?
So I have to first start off and say really quick that I have to send a happy birthday to my sister. Today's her birthday, so happy birthday, Emily.
Woo! Happy birthday!
Happy birthday!
Great. Well, so some other things other than LiDAR that we're using out there. You can even use imagery that's your classic red, green, and blue imagery. And another one that has proven useful is thermal imagery. And thermal imagery is used to sense heat. And there's some very good applications of using thermal imagery for environmental monitoring. So authorized by the Clean Water Act, the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System is a permitting program by the EPA that looks for pipes, point source pollution such as pipes or man-made ditches. And the caveat with this is that you're not allowed to actually discharge into these waterways without a permit. And one way that we can do a wide area assessment of where potential illicit discharges are occurring is
Sounds dirty.
Illicit discharge, it is. It's got to clean it up.
Clean it up.
We can use thermal imagery. And what we end up doing is in the middle of the winter, when the ground is the coldest, we end up taking a plane up and we use a thermal sensor. And because the ground and the water that's outside is so much cooler than any water that would be coming from an indoor source, we're able to go ahead and look through that imagery and assess points where we think that there could be potential illicit discharge.
So just by looking at a few images, you're able to do work that could easily take a 20 crew team the whole season, right?
Exactly. So instead of the individual team members driving around and walking up and down creek beds, stream beds, and the like, we're able to, in one night, fly the imagery. And then with some processing that needs to go on to clean up the imagery, then after that, we're able to actually look for what we call plumes and just anything that's almost like a teardrop shape, because that is essentially indicating that the water temperature is higher than what the surrounding temperature is. And then obviously as it moves downstream, it creates a little tail. And so using that, we can just do a little manual dropping of a point on the screen, which will create an XY coordinate. And then we pass those coordinates on to the crews, and the crews can then go out and quickly and easily find these areas and check on whether or not it just happens to be a very turbid day or that a rock fell in the river and therefore changed the flow, creating, you know, more friction and indicating a potential increase in temperature. So those are some very readily available technologies that municipalities and industrial areas and the like actually use. One other type of thing that we end up doing a lot of, and that's some habitat assessments and some, like I was mentioning earlier, some timber assessments. And we've got an interesting project going on right now that's using a combination of infrared imagery, which we spoke a little about earlier, LiDAR imagery, and color and color infrared imagery. And that project specifically is looking at, in essence, a cost-benefit relationship, cost-benefit analysis between returns on dropping a tree to increase habitat along a river And this river in particular had been used quite frequently to float logs down the river to the timber mill. And floating logs down a river ends up, in essence, always scraping the bottom of the riverbed, and then also at the same time cleaning a lot of debris out from the edges of the river. And when that happens, it increases the flow of water. And so with that increased flow of water, fish habitats decline. And what this particular client was looking for was, once we can identify the tree and the general tree species, that along with the height, we can determine whether or not this tree might be better for timber production, or better to actually just have it dropped and rolled into the river to create habitat for different types of fish. And I think this leads great into what David's doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
David, you're also working on a project with rivers, right?
Yes, I am. One of the big projects that's taken up a lot of my time this past year is one that's in collaboration with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, whose primary focus is sea lamprey control in the Great Lakes Basin.
What are sea lamprey?
Well, the best way to see what they are is to actually look at them, because they're disgusting.
Let's see.
But for those of you who are unfamiliar, sea lamprey are a type of parasitic fish that actually will, using their suction cup mouth, it looks a lot
disgusting. We just pulled up a picture of them.
Their mouth is like something that can suck on anything.
Yeah. They attach themselves to the sides of fish and feed off of their, their blood and their other things. It's pretty gross. But the issue is that they can have a pretty huge negative impact on the Great Lakes fishery. As an invasive species, they are the hosts are less likely to survive in the Great Lakes here than in the Atlantic, where they are actually native. In support of that control effort, my project has been to help develop a web mapping application, a viewer that can be viewed online by the general public, by sea lamprey control agents, to basically kind of see the effect of removing barriers in the Great Lakes Basin. It's been a little bit more of a popular option in more recent years to try to restore connectivity for fish habitat for naturally occurring species, but something that we wanted to be able to show the public and people making those decisions was the impact that could potentially have on the spread of sea lamprey, because sea lamprey actually go from the lake to up into the tributaries to spawn. So
you're modeling what sea lamprey migration would look like if barriers are removed, is that right? Or are you looking at things that have already happened?
So basically what we're doing is we are, from a particular barrier of interest that could be removed, usually a dam, we are opening up, kind of tracing along the tributaries and the various upstream water features to show visually where they could potentially migrate to if the habitat is ideal for spawning.
So after the public have seen the images, how are they going to make decisions differently? Like, what does that process look like?
This tool specifically is not necessarily to give a final a conclusion one way or the other.
Okay.
The point was basically to just increase the kind of spatial awareness and understanding of the general public, policymakers, anyone who would be involved in a barrier removal decision. There are other tools out there that show similar features, in terms of, upstream passability for fish. And one thing that we wanted to do was to actually display visually what that network, that web of streams actually looks like, because I think that has a lot more impact than actually just seeing the number, how many miles is upstream of this And the issue with sea lamprey specifically is that the other methods of control, primarily lampricide, which is a highly effective and very selective chemical that will take out the sea lamprey in a tributary.
It will kill it.
it's very expensive. It's, you know, very, it's a kind of very specific to the Great Lakes. Nobody else really uses these chemicals. So controlling the cost of treatment is very important, and these barriers play a huge role in that. So that's,
this is one of the things that GIS is really effective at, is helping understand, helping decision makers understand the various trade-offs between decisions that they can make. Like, on the one hand, you have a desire to have more connected tributaries and more connected ecological systems. On the other hand, you have to have barriers to keep sea lamprey from coming all the way into tributaries. So how do you decide which barriers to remove to have the lowest impact on sea lampreys coming into the tributaries? And that's what makes the technology so useful, I think. So I just want to shift a little bit to something a little lighter, which is that our two guests in the studio, they share that they are both GIS professionals. What they don't know is that they also share something else, which is...
They are both from...
Ohio.
All right.
Undisputed national champions.
So we have a special song for you guys to bring you back home. It's Ohio by the Ohio Players.
Michigan.
Michigan. At least we're not Ohio. Welcome back to WCBN FM Ann Arbor, home of the Michigan Wolverines. Go Blue. Actually, I'm a Spartan fan, but don't tell anyone. So we're back, and we're going to chat a little bit about special news this week, which is that the Michigan Task Force on pipelines and petroleum released a report on Line 5, which is the pipeline that runs beneath the Mackinac Straits that's covered in zebra mussels. And they are worried about this pipeline breaking and spreading oil into lakes. And one of the things that they recommended was having a better understanding through mapping and GIS of where these pipelines are actually located. And David, I know you're working on some stuff around oil. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're looking at and if you think it could help with some of these issues with Line 5?
Sure. One of the things that I work on is a product called the Inland Sensitivity Atlas, and it's a map that covers the Great Lakes states, and it basically is a tool that can be used in the field by for responders and people involved in oil spill cleanup to know what relevant things are in the area. So some of the included information is, like you said, the location of pipelines to know where some spills may have originated, as well as information about the location of sensitive habitat for endangered species or threatened species, water intakes, and things of that nature that would be of high priority to a cleanup effort.
So this is just one of the many ways that the Great Lakes Commission serves the needs of the states. When they issue a report and say, we need this, the Great Lakes Commission can step up and say, we're actually already doing it. Isn't that right?
Well, and that's actually something that's in cooperation with a few other organizations and agencies. And that's, you know, part of the nature of working with the Great Lakes Commission is one of the goals of the Great Lakes Commission is the consensus building and collaboration. So, working with various agencies and with data from various agencies is one of the benefits and the challenges.
And so when you're doing your mapping, you're looking at where the pipelines are. And do you have anything related to water, whether it's the big lakes or tributaries, and how oil might affect those?
Yes, I've actually been just recently working on a new mapping product that is an analysis tool that basically will allow a user to get a rough understanding of what the potential timeline could look like for the spread of oil down a stream that would feed into the Great Lakes. So it could give you an understanding of how far it might travel in an hour, in 6 hours, or how much time it might take before it's actually reached open water, which an open water cleanup is, I think, a lot more involved. So
yeah, a lot more involved and a lot more awful.
Yeah,
I'm interested in it. Do you have the website?
This is not something that's hosted yet,
okay,
because it's actually still in development.
Mm-hmm.
This is a relatively new project, and it uses the... So the USGS is the one that puts out the data that...
and that's the U.S. Geological Survey.
Yes.
Right?
Thank you, Sam.
And they put out the National Hydrography Dataset, which is a fairly complete model of the streams and other water bodies all over the country. And the EPA has actually created their own product called the NHD Plus, which also includes stream gauges and things like that that help to create flow estimates and velocity estimates for streams in across the nation, but more specifically for us in the Great Lakes. So this product uses those estimates and allows the user to either select a time of year, so a specific month, monthly estimate for flow, or to take the maximum estimate of flow from the whole year and just give yourself a worst case scenario. How far could this oil travel downstream before we get there to clean it up?
So you mentioned something that I probably should have mentioned earlier, and that's actually on the ground data. You're mentioning some of these repeated measurement sites that are set up, and that's actually one pretty important caveat that I accidentally left out earlier, was that a lot of this data has to be supported with some ground or field site data as well. That helps in multiple ways, not only to understand the geography from a first person perspective, but also to be able to understand potentially some of the limitations of the data, the limitations of the model that you're using to extrapolate or interpolate data. And ground and field verification are a very important aspect of any of this type of environmental work.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. We can't trust everything that we see from space. Like, what if there's a piece of dust on the camera? You might see something that's not there.
And especially for our work particularly, we're receiving data from, unlike Mark, where you guys develop a lot of your own data or take your own measurements. We're receiving our data from different organizations in various levels of quality and with different kind of standards for how it's organized. So bringing those together and verifying them is a big concern for making sure that we have an accurate product.
So I was hoping that you could tell me a little bit more about where the actual pipeline location data comes from, or maybe I just missed that.
The pipeline location data actually is, it is something that is not publicly distributed.
Understandably.
Yeah, because of various concerns. But that comes from the, it's an agency, it's called PHMSA, and I believe it stands for Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Agency, something like that. And they are the national agency control of that data.
Interesting. I know that Quantum Spatial has been working with some utility companies specifically for pipelines. And again, that word's going to come up, LIDAR. They were able to actually use that because of the level of detail that they can get. And they were using that actually for the land-based pipelines, the particular example I know about. And they're actually able to look at each individual pipe segment. And because the LIDAR data is so precise with the elevation of an object or the surface point of an object, that they can actually, again, with quite good accuracy, I think around 3 centimeters, tell whether or not these pipelines are actually shifting or turning. And obviously they would fly that multiple times over the course of however many times of a year or yearly that they needed to actually do that. And from there, they can start to look at how the ground's shifting underneath some of these pipelines to help try to prevent some of the unfortunate oil spill disasters that do occur.
Yeah, that's just a great example of, one of the many really useful applications of LIDAR, and to be able to keep track of something like that, it's really something that you couldn't do on a grand scale quite as easily. So, without it,
yeah, it's mind blowing.
Yeah. It really is.
So I have to jump in and say one other thing about these this LIDAR data, and essentially what they refer to those as well is just a 3D point cloud, and so you know the X, Y, and Z coordinates of objects. And to complement that, because LIDAR is still expensive for some end users, they're actually able to use imagery as well. And using imagery, they call this photogrammetric point cloud generation. And for short, they call
that 10 times fast.
That's why they created this nice little acronym that's kind of deceiving called FODAR. And so what FODAR does is it utilizes the overlap of imagery that's taken when a plane or a satellite actually flies part of the surface of the Earth. And the nice thing about digital data now is that, in essence, overlap has never has become less and less of an issue and more easily obtained because of the fact that we can store it so readily. And using this overlap, if you think about it, if you have the plane flying overhead and it goes over your right shoulder, and then the same plane turns around and comes back and goes over your left shoulder. If you think about how a lens works, you're actually getting two different angles on the same point. And so by using those two images, you can actually build up a digital surface model, which doesn't quite have the penetration of LIDAR, because LIDAR is an active sensor and it's going to penetrate through tree canopies, shrubs, and stuff like that. And photographs are 2D, images, so you don't have any depth until you use that overlap. Mm-hmm. And so I just had to mention that because that's definitely something that's coming around in the remote sensing and GIS world as well.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break for some tunes. We're going to do a tribute to the Grateful Dead, who played their very last show recently. And it was one of the only places where you might just pick something up off the floor and snort it, is what they were saying at the Grateful Dead concert. And it's what else was over? There was a great article online. It was called "Overheard at the Grateful Dead Concert," and there was also one where someone said, "Mom, can you clean yourself up? You look like a hippie." And the mom said,
"You can't clean out the inside.
Can't take the hippie off the inside." All right, let's listen to "Truckin'" by the Grateful Dead.
Truckin', got my chips cashed in. Keep truckin', like the doo-dah man. Together, more or less in line. Just keep truckin' on, on, on. Arrows of neon and flashing marquees out on Main Street. Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's all on the same street. A typical city involved in a typical daydream. Hang it up and see what tomorrow brings. Dallas, got a soft machine. Houston, too close to New Orleans. New York, got the ways and means. And just won't let you be. You meet on the streets because true love. Most of the time they're sitting and crying at home. One of these days they know they gotta get going. Out of the door and down to the street all alone. Chugging like a doo-dah man. Once told me you got to pay your hand. Sometimes the cards ain't worth a dime if you don't lay them down. Thank you.
says to me, what a long, strange trip it's been. Trucking, I'm going home. Whoa, whoa,
welcome back to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is It's Hot in Here. We're joined by Mark Yoders with Quantum Spatial and David Betcher with the Great Lakes Commission, and we're chatting about ArcGIS, Esri, which a lot of folks have a little bit of a love-hate relationship with, and we're going to do a bit of celebrating Festivus in July. Festivus is the holiday celebrated by the Costanzas, where instead of celebrating a holiday, you air your grievances, and then you there's also a battle where you have to wrestle, but we're not going to wrestle in the studio. But we are going to do an airing of the grievances on Esri, ArcGIS, and like the ridiculous stuff that happens when you're trying to use it. What are some of your least favorite moments with Esri?
Well, as you may imagine, it's a very complicated set of tools, so there's a lot that can go wrong, and when it does, there are often error messages that will pop up, and many times they have a numeric code. All of our favorite, I believe, is the standard 9999, which is a general error, no other information, and it happens for very many reasons, but The best part is it likes to toy with you, because then it'll say, well, click on the message for more information. And when you click on the message for more information, it will take you to a page that has the exact same error message. So it's a little frustrating.
99999. Yeah, like what does that even mean?
I don't know. It's the stuff of nightmares, I tell you.
Well, I like, what's your favorite Esri tool, David? I think I've seen it on your desk.
Oh, yeah, well, okay, I have, this is actually there, it greeted me when I first arrived to my cubicle, but it's a picture, and it's one of those, sort of like a motivational poster, and it has a picture of a hammer, but you have the handle, and then you have a chain leading to the head of the hammer, and it says Esri, because good tools matter. So, yeah, it's a perfect illustration of the usefulness.
Right, because sometimes you just need to like smash the computer. But really, we know deep down that it's user error, that Esri did everything.
Yeah, that's true. It's all my fault, which is why I get so frustrated.
It's the worst.
I think that sometimes, depending on the imagery that you're trying to load, or if you don't have the projection correct, that you end up with these things that we like to refer to as arc mysteries, because we really don't know why it's behaving in a certain way.
Yeah,
it's actually, you have to pay extra for that package, right? The arc mysteries package.
Yeah, I think it's an add-on package. Yeah. One of their add-ons. Yeah.
It
extensions.
Yeah, I
it's
think
next to spatial analyst.
Yeah,
and then arc mystery add-on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're gonna end the show today with a shout out to CubeLand. What's up, CubeLand?
Hello, CubeLand.
Hope you're listening. If you need help with the Friday crossword, we'll be back soon. And we're going to close with the story of Festivus. So listen up and enjoy. Thanks for joining us today.
And thanks for
our many Christmases
audio
ago, I went to buy a doll for my son. I reached for the last one they had, but so did another man. As I rained blows upon him, I realized there had to be another way.
What happened to the doll?
It was destroyed. But out of that, a new holiday was born. A Festivus for the rest of us.
That must have been some kind of doll.
She was. And at the Festivus dinner, you gather your family around and tell them all the ways they have disappointed you over the past year.
And is there a tree?
No, instead there's a pole. Requires no decoration. I find tinsel distracting. It's made from aluminum. Very high strength to weight ratio. Until you pin me, George, Festivus is not over. Festivus is your heritage. It is part of who you are.